And as you will see from my talk, I come from a different background from most of the talks that you've heard today, so there will be a little bit of a switch of gear. But I've learned a lot during this conference. So what I think the organizer asked me, and if they didn't, too late to change their mind, is anything with large scale structure. Sorry, did you go? And so, here are the references, not because you have to remember them all, but because I want to highlight the young people in my group in Barcelona that did the work. Some of them are still there, and some of them have moved to greener pasture. And so these are the graduates, postdoc Beatriz, the graduate student Anna Mangili, and Carmelita Carbone and Olga Mena. And so what's the basic motivation? Well, after Matthias talked yesterday, I can go very quickly through this. The simplest inflationary models predict very small deviation from Gaussian initial condition, but you can always ask how small is small or how simple is simple, and can in some models small be at the level of being detectable? And also there can always be non-standard models, I don't know, strings, defects, etc., that can give you larger primordial non-Gaussianity. Now, the approach with large scale structure is fully complementary, but the approach of looking for primordial non-Gaussianity, I should say, fully complementary to the approach of looking for tensor to scalar radio, ratio, that is primordial tensor mode in the cosmic microwave background, because it's both of them are a window into the mechanism that lay down the primordial perturbations, call it inflation, or call it whatever you want to call it. But when you look at the larger scale structure, for larger scale structure, you don't need a dedicated telescope or a dedicated survey to go after primordial non-Gaussianity, because the data will be gathered anyway by those experiments that go after dark energy. And so it could go under ancillary science for them, and they'll take the data for you automatically. Okay. And so I should introduce the concept of shapes here. So the simplest inflationary model, that is one field, canonical kinetic energy, slow roll, banded vacuum, give a small non-Gaussianity that is called of the local type. The local type means that it's written like a Gaussian plus something proportional to the square of a Gaussian. To interpret this, we need to look at the bispectrum, which is a three-point function in Fourier space. And so the bispectrum, as we've seen, is a function of the 3K mode. And one can consider, and the literature has been considered, several different configurations, the squeezed, the equilateral, or the folded. And that is where the bispectrum is dominated by what sort of type of configuration. And something that has been developed in the past, 5 to 10 years, is that a violation of each of those conditions out there leaves its signature in the shape of the biospectrum. And the references are too many, so I just give you the reference to a white paper where all the references are reported for this. So the big advantage of looking at the cosmic microwave biospectrum is that the shape, it's already there, because you actually look exactly at this quantity. But the disadvantage is that you are looking at a two-dimensional information of something that is at a given redshift. And so you can ask yourself, what about looking at the lower redshift universe? And so for now, we just concentrate on the biospectrum. And so let me say a word about the non-Gaussianity parameter FNL. In principle, it should be defined in Fourier space through the biospectrum, and in general, it can be a complex dependence on the K vectors. But, you know, the workhorse model for non-Gaussianity is the local model, where you just say, well, it's a Gaussian plus something proportional to the square of a Gaussian, and let's assume that that term is constant. So this is called the local model, and it's typical when non-Gaussianity is generated outside the horizon. There are some details. This is defined on the gravitational potential, so be careful with the sign. Different authors and same authors in different papers change signs, but be careful. So the measures of this non-Gaussianity or FNL allow us to constrain inflationary models. And probably here I'm preaching to the converted, but let me go through this very, very, very simple example that is relative to the single field inflation. So remember the slow roll parameters and remember the definition of the skewness for the phi field, the non-Gaussian one, and the skewness can be related to FNL, but also can be related to the slow roll parameters. And so we know that the slope can be measured, for example, from the power spectrum of the cosmic microwave background, either alone or combining it with large scale structural data. And then if you do a very, very simple math, it turns out that by combining and with determination of FNL, you can get a handle on the slow roll parameters. And so all the models that have the large eta problem, then you can start constraining some of them if you have constraints on FNL. Now, you will see there is somewhat of a sociological issue with the references. There are a lot of references that I will show you from almost 10 years ago and a lot of references from basically the day before yesterday. So this is what happened to the field, at least from the cosmology point of view. There was a lot of interest in this at the end of the last century. And then something happened, and then a couple of years ago, the field got revitalized. And so, and this is related to the energy scale of inflation, because remember that the low roll parameter is related to the density scalar ratio. And we should recall that the cosmic microwave background polarization detection of this will be very challenging. And some of you were at the CMB Paul working group meeting in Chicago a couple of years ago when people actually tried to come up with some number and see what the next generation experiment could actually do. And this is basically a realization of the light bound, where you can see that models that move a lot, where the field moves a lot during inflation, gives you probably detectable amount of density scalarization, but the one that moved little not. So this is the calculation that we did at that point, and we repeated with more up-to-date foregrounds and noise from the instrument in this paper. So this is an ideal experiment, but we are not going to get this. What we are going to get is probably something like that. So this model can be seen, but this model cannot be seen. So galaxy surveys, what tools do we have? Well, like for the cosmic microwave background, you have the bispectrum of higher order correlation function. And, the basics for this is probably in Jim's paper from the 1980s. So it's not something new. And the higher order correlation function in galaxy survey have been detected. The galaxy distribution is non-Gaussian. But most of the non-Gaussianity you see, if not all of the non-Gaussianity you see, come from gravity. Gravity is a non-linear process. And then something new, that it's new of a couple of years, is looking at the clustering of the peaks on larger scales. And then you have the handle of looking at the abundance of rare events, say peaks of massive halos, and then topology. And I will concentrate on this because it's a quite promising avenue. But I'm going to say something about it. So searching for non-Gaussianity with large-scale structure, it's complementary, and it's complementary in several different ways. So each probe is affected by different systematics. So when you think about the clustering, like the bispectrum or the trispectrum, they are affected by gravity, which generates non-Gaussianity. The trispectrum may be interesting because to the leading order, then gravity doesn't give you a trispectrum, it gives you to the next order. When you think about abundance of rare event, you're looking at the tail of the mass function, and so the warning is, what is a halo, right? A halo is a man-made concept. And what's its mass? When you see an object out there, how do you determine its mass? And what is a mass function? And you know that there has been work going on for at least 20 years or more on this. But anyway, this is interesting because this is a probably confusing plot. What this plot wants to say is that with large-scale structure, you can probe scales that are smaller than the CMB scales. And so if there is any scale dependent, then you have a wider baseline to be able to see. So I'm plotting K and FNL. And then these are constrained from the CNB. These different colors are different probes. And this is some model domain at some time. And so, so if you look at the Bayes spectrum, and in this paper here, we show that the constraint from primordial longus anything, the gravitational potential that you can get from redshift survey like the degree field galaxy redshift survey or the Sloan digital sky survey are not really competitive with the cosmic microwave background. So your FNL needs to be of order of 100 in order to be detected as a sort of non-linear bias in the galaxy to dark matter relation. What do I mean by bias? Well, we know that you can predict the dark matter power spectrum, but you don't observe the dark matter power spectrum. You observe the galaxy power spectrum, and the two may not be simply related to one another. And so this mismatch is called bias. Larger scale structure can give you complementary constraint because it has different scales that cosmic microwave background. What you may want to do, you may want to go to higher redshift and make larger scale structure competitive with the cosmic microwave background. Why is this? Well, imagine you start off with a field that is almost Gaussian with a small non-Gaussianity, okay? Then gravity acts for the 13 billion years of the evolution of the universe, and so the non-Gaussianity from the gravitational evolution grows and swamps the primordial one. And so in your signal to noise, you know, this contribution, which is the one you are going for, gets swamped. But if you go to high redshift, you undo this, and then you can access the primordial signal a little bit more easily. The other thing you can do, you can look at the abundance of rare events. So besides using the standard statistical estimator like the Bayes spectrum or the Dry spectrum, whatever, you can look at the tail of the distribution, that is the rare event. Rare events have the advantage that they maximize deviation from what is predicted from Gaussian initial condition, but they have the obvious disadvantage that they are rare. So primordial non-Gaussianity affects the abundance of the very first nonlinear object in the universe, so they could, say, modify things like the reionization history, etc. And so about 10 years ago, we came up with a form for the non-Gaussian mass function and realized that basically this approach, while looking at rare events like clusters of galaxies at high redshift, you can probe non-Gaussianity down to a few tens, which is again is not competitive with future cosmic background Planck constraints. And voids could also be rare events. If you find a very, very large void, maybe competitive. And now this mass function was later improved when, you know, the subject became hot again. And this paper, I should highlight Sarah Sandera, who is here, and this has been tested on simulation, et cetera, et cetera. And I should say that the paper that came out a couple of weeks ago showed that this mass function, if you take it to the second order, it's basically as good as you can get. You don't need much better because the small deviation that remain from what they predict to be the reality are smaller than what you would ever measure even if you're 75 meters. So that's pleasing to see. So how does it work? So let's present things in the Press-Schechter approach because it's easier to understand. So in the Press-Schechter approach, you want to know what is the number of objects I have in the sky in a given mass interval. And so what Press-Schechter told us that this is related to the probability of having objects above a given threshold, that is the threshold after which the object collapses. And so non-Gaussianity changes this probability. In a Gaussian case, it's easy to compute. In a non-Gaussian case, it's not so trivial, especially in the tails. Now, the non-Gaussian mass function was derived in the Press-Schechter frameworks. We know that the Press-Schechter framework fails at some point because it basically is non-spherical collapse, and collapse, we know, is not spherical. So what is recommended to do is to predict the ratio of the non-Gaussian to Gaussian abundance, and then compare these two observations that are normalized to numerically calibrate the Gaussian prediction. And now that's somebody else's problem, because it's the problem of people that want to use the abundance of rare event or object clusters to do, say, dark energy things like that. And so, of course, this must be calibrated on n-body simulation, and the work has already started, and here are a few references. And so this is a lightning fast history of the non-Gaussian mass function, but I'm gonna skip through this. And I'm gonna go and instead talk about the non-Gaussian halo bias, which is basically the clustering of rare events. So if you have a Gaussian field and a non-Gaussian field, they can both have the same power spectrum, right? But in a Gaussian field, the power spectrum of the peaks, it's completely specified by the underlying power spectrum, because the power spectrum gives you everything you need to do about your Gaussian field. In a non-Gaussian field, however, the power spectrum of the peaks depend on all the higher order correlation. That is, it depends also on FNL, which is the quantity you're interested in. Now, this is from the mathematical theoretical point of view, but from a more observational point of view, we can rephrase it in the following way. Non-Gaussian initial condition and Gaussian initial condition can end up giving you the same power spectrum for the dark matter. But for Gaussian initial condition, the power spectrum of massive halo is completely specified by the power spectrum of the dark matter. For non-Gaussian initial condition, however, the power spectrum of the halos, identifying halos with peaks or rare events of your underlying field, depends on all the higher order correlations, including FNL. So for Gaussian initial condition, it is known since the 80s, what is called the Kaiser formula, that the correlation function or the power spectrum of halo, where halo are represented by the peak of your Gaussian field, it has the same shape for high threshold, has the same shape as the underlying dark matter power spectrum, but is boosted up by a bias. Now, in the 90s, this particular prescription was improved, but still the gist of the message is the same. On large scales, this kind of bias is scale independent. That is, the dark matter power spectrum and your halo tracer power spectrum have the same shape. Now, on a small scale, this may not be the case, but on large scale, it's pretty much so. For non-Gaussian initial condition, however, you don't end up with something as simple as this. You end up with something that is scale-dependent, so you have a scale-dependent bias on top of the Gaussian one and actually proportional to the Gaussian one. And here are the relevant references, and I should highlight a couple of pioneering work on this idea. One is by Dalal and collaborators, and one is by Nayesh Tolly, and I should highlight that these two are here, and these people are not far away from here. There. So let me describe a little bit more what is the effect that we are talking about. So here I wrote what you expect to see, that is the correction to the bias due to non-Gaussianity divided by your Gaussian bias. Okay. And we can write it as the product of two terms, a term that depend on scale and a term that depends on ratio. And this complicated expression I wrote here, it's simply an expression that where we generalize to all by spectra the effect that was first actually derived only for the local case. The local case, it's relatively simple to derive the effect because you can write your non-Gaussian field as a function of the underlying Gaussian one, and you then have to take a square. If you want a general bias spectrum, then the final expression complicates a little bit. So, but the point is you can factorize it in a term that depends on scale and a term that depends on redshift. So the redshift dependence bit goes this way. This is redshift, and this is how it goes up with redshift. So the effect is going to be larger at higher redshift. Well, peaks are becoming more rare as you go to higher redshift, and so it's not surprising. And this is the scale-dependent peak. So again, so this is scale, and this is this term here, which is the part that defines the scale. And I'm showing you several different cases here, and this is normalized to an FNL of unity, just so you know what we're talking about. So this is the case for local. This is the case for the unfolded shape, and this is the case for equilateral. So we're seeing a couple of things here. For the local case, there is a strong scale dependent of this halo bias, and we can probably understand why. It's because you did your Nonghausen operation in the gravitational potential, but then you observe it in the density. And the Poisson equation introduced some k dependence in comparing between one and the other one. And this is this 1/k² dependence that we see in the local case. For the equilateral case, there is a subtle cancellation. So when you do this integral, basically the effect dies off. And this is was also noted by Tarugli and collaborators before. In the unfolded case, it's a little bit suppressed with respect to the local one, but there is still a signal there. And probably we can understand here what's going on. So in the standard, say, thick background split, what you have the long wavelength mode of your Gaussian field, and then you have shorter wavelength mode on top. And the shorter wavelengths are the ones that are going to form halos and galaxies. And the longest wavelengths one are the ones that are going to boost these small little peaks above this threshold for collapse. So what in a Gaussian case, the long wavelength and the short wavelength are not correlated. But in a non-Gaussian case, they are. And if you think about the local non-Gaussianity, you are correlating very small scale with very large scale because it's squeezed configuration. So it's not surprising that the local non-Gaussianity gives you a huge effect because by hand, you are coupling large scale with small scale.
Enfolded means?
Enfolded is the one that has got the two sides that are half of the other side. So it's squeezed this way rather than squeezed where you have one small side and two
local
very long
is
side.
One short side?
Local is one very short side and two very long sides.
Okay.
So can you do something else with equilateral, like say something about the shape of the halos or something, you know, since you do have you still have some correlations.
So this, if you look at this, if you just look at the power spectrum of the high density peaks, it's all in this integral. So that's your pi spectrum, and all the shape information is here, and you're integrating over it. So it's a little bit like looking at the skewness.
Over the pi spectrum.
So,
I understand it's not in that particular quantity.
So you would have to look at something like, you know, pi spectrum or something that is from extra shape information, and then the interesting thing of this is that the effect is on so large scales that you can forget about all the non-linearities. Well, if you want to go and look at bi-spectrum, a lot of the signal to noise is on small scales and then all the non-linearities. So this effect is it's interesting. It has been calibrated on simulation, and here I'm just showing very quickly some tests that we have done, but there have been parallel work confirming the results. So this is simply calibrating the redshift dependence part, and this is calibrating the scale dependent part, and so far it has been tested on non-Gaussian initial condition for the local type of non-Gaussianity. And it's important to have different group testing this because setting out the initial condition not completely straightforward, so you want to make sure that this is done right. Okay, so what are the current constraints that we have following this this approach? So for the local type, the current constraints are reported here, and with the relative references here, and I don't want you to look into much details about this, but just to understand the main message. The main message is that from the cosmic microwave background biospectrum, the constraint we have is, you know, with an error bar that the 1 sigma level is plus or minus 20. And when you look at these numbers, the error bars are getting there. They are not too far away, even though this was done on surveys that were not thought for this. And these surveys don't cover a very large volume. There will be surveys that are much more suited to do with an experiment like that. And this links it together to interesting picture of this approach. So since you are looking for a broad band, say a smooth feature in K and a smooth feature in redshift of something at very large scales, the standard photometric redshift accuracy will do. So you don't necessarily need a spectroscopic redshift survey. A photometric survey will do as well. And it's much easier to go to much larger volumes a much deeper inversion with photometric rather than spectroscopic survey. And also, again, you can get something for free, because this is the plot of the shape of the power spectrum, and this highlighted is the region where the baryonic acoustic oscillation signal is. And so a lot of surveys are going on to go after the baryonic acoustic oscillation signal, to go after dark energy. And this kind of survey needs large volume, because this is a small signal, you want many modes to see. And also you need a sharp noise, that is an amber density of galaxies, so that these wiggles are above your sharp noise level. So this is the sharp noise level of these surveys. Now you go to the other side of the bump, and you find out that the non-Gaussian signal is localized there. And if you want to see it, you need a large volume. And you need a sharp noise that is, you know, more or less at the same level that you have for baryonic acoustic oscillation surveys. So basically, you know, again, you can get your data for free. So how well can these do? So this is some forecast for several different surveys. Some of them are already ongoing, ongoing, probably, we don't know, planned, this is already going, and this is planned. But the main point here is look at the error bars. You can start seeing error bars that are of the order of unity. And when we get to an error bar on FNL of order unity, then it starts getting very interesting. Now, these are Fisher metric forecasts, so they should always be taken with a grain of salt, because, you know, Fisher metrics is always optimistic. But there is an interesting feature that we can keep in mind, is that this is a relative effect, is a delta V over V, that's your signal, okay? And so this idea has been put forward in the last year by Uroselczak and Hansi Schlosser and collaborators, that if you have several differently biased tracers, you can get rid of a lot of the cosmic variance by simply taking the ratio of the clustering between tracer to the same underlying field that are differently biased. And a lot of this error is dominated by cosmic variance. So if you can get rid of cosmic variance, you can further shrink these errors. Now, how well you can do in a practical application, so we don't know. There have been some work done by Gilmarin et al. Where we show that you can improve by order of unity your error bars, not necessarily by order of magnitude, because differently biased tracers may not be exactly, you know, following exactly the same underlying field. There may be some stochasticity, the way galaxy form on the underlying distributions we have to take that into account. But, you know, let's keep in mind that future survey can give you error bars of order unity. And we may want to compare this with forecasts that you can have from cosmic microwave background surveys. And so this is the Planck bispectrum constraint on FNL local, and this is something like a B-pole or a CMB-pole experiment. You know, next generation, you can get to error bars of order 2, and you can compare with this, and you get error bars that are, you know, smaller or at least comparable. Now, this approach is sensitive to the shape. This approach is not too sensitive to the shape, okay? So. But the nice thing is that there is no much degeneracy with cosmology when you look at this approach. Basically, you would think that if you mess around with the shape of the primordial power spectrum, you could somewhat lose your sensitivity to this effect. But what it turns out is that its peculiar redshift dependence help you disentangle it from effects like, say, neutrino mass, dark energy clustering, or things that can mess up things on very large scales. Okay. So we are getting to error bars of order unity. Why is that interesting? Or this is all an academic exercise. Are we going to get a null result at the time we are going to do it or not? And the answer is probably not. Probably not, because there are other effects. So other effects are not relevant on, linear effects are not relevant on those scales, but there could be other effects that are peculiar to large scale structures that may actually show up. And this is this effect I want to talk about here. So there is some inflationary GR type non-Gaussianity, or something that looks like non-Gaussianity, which is intrinsic to large scale structure. So basically what happens is that the Poisson equation on such a large scale gets non-linear correction. And it looks to you like if there was some effective bispectrum in there. And the form of the bispectrum would be this form, so this is the primordial one, which we know is very small for a single field. But then you get this thing there, and this thing is, you know, looks like something like that. And so basically, in order for you to see this, I mean, even if the Poisson equation gets quadratic correction, you need the initial condition set up like inflation, right? Because you need something that is, say, a Gaussian plus something that depends on the same Gaussian. If it was depending on something that was completely unrelated, then you wouldn't get the signal. You get a Weiss vector signal.
Yes, but it's not gravitational perturbation theory. It's just the Poisson equation get this kind of correction. So there may also be an effect like that, but it's not, does not affect the scales that we can.
Sorry,
but it's the same type of calculation. And it's done there and there.
But where is this correction coming from?
The Poisson equation on very large scales.
But that's part of the gravitational equation, right? So it's a gravitational correction, no?
Yes. So this kind of effect, it's now also plotted in this plot, and remember this is the absolute value because that's in fact gives the sign. But it's basically look a lot like a local type of non-Gaussianity with an amplitude that is of the order of 1.6. Remember that the error part that we were forecasting were at this level or below, and so this could be at a potentially detectable level. So this is very interesting. So we started thinking about whether it could be screwed up, whether you could screw it up, something like that. So let's think about it. We are looking at extremely large scales. And so things like, you know, nonlinear bias, nonlinearity, things like that may actually not change the shape of the power spectrum so much. I mean, if you think about it, we want to measure the BAEO location with a better than percent accuracy. And if all this gastrophysics doesn't affect the baryonic acoustic oscillation, it's not likely to affect scales that are even larger than that. But we thought really hard, and then we come up with something. And that's something, it's called assembly bias. Now, there is a big discussion about assembly bias in the Gaussian case. And in the Gaussian case, there is some effect, but the effect is small. What is assembly bias? Well, if you take a bunch of halos that they have all the same mass, some of them are formed earlier and some of them are formed later. And the ones that are formed earlier are a little bit rarer than the ones that are formed later, even though they have the same mass. And so their clustering properties, their mass function, etc., may be slightly different from that of the average population. And so it's easy to derive this in the peak background split approach, and in this paper, these people basically derive this non-Gaussian halo bias in the peak background split approach.
And but this can be done in the local case only, but it's one of the cases we are really interested in, so let's keep on going. So with Beth Reed, we decided to basically use the standard Bresch-Schechter approach and see whether the formation time of the halo could leave some imprint into this non-Gaussian correction to the halo bias. And so it turns out that the correction to the bias due to non-Gaussianity can be written as a sum of two terms. So this is the standard one that you get in the big background split. And here, normally, you get minus one when you average over the entire population, so for a given mass interval, all the halos that form, you know, recently or older. But if you split it in formation redshift, then you get this, and this is the probability distribution. Now, this is very nice because it's all written in terms of Gaussian quantities. And so we could simply go and check how important this term is in looking at, when we go and look at the various details on very large Gaussian simulation, even though in order to check this effect, we actually look at non-Gaussian simulations. And so this is the result. This is this correction here. The points are points from the simulations, and the lines are the theory lines that, from what I showed you before. And so basically, the halos have been split from old halos and young halos. And by old halo, so young halo, I define some certain fraction of the current mass, and I ask, when does the halo accrete that fraction of its final mass? And that fraction here is half, and here is 75%. So it works extremely well. And it works probably better than you expect. It's simply because the way we decided to bin things, it's done in this variable here, and this is the natural variable in the standard Bresch-Schechter approach. So basically, any mismatch that you can find between a standard projector and observation is just the mapping between this variable and the interpretation of this variable in terms of sigma and delta sigma. But I mean, the message that I want to give to the ones that are not aficionados is that, yes, there is an effect. It's an important effect that depends on when the halo was formed. So basically, the effect is asymmetric between old and young halos. Even if the tracer population excludes only 10% of the oldest halo, the value of the correction that you get from the remaining 90% of the halo can differ from the full sample by, you know, 44. So, you know, 40%. Now, then we check that using a sample that is the closest possible as the sample of recent mergers, then you recover what was derived in the standard projector approach and you get what you expect. But of course, between theory and observation, there is an ocean. So far, we've just dealt with, you know, halos and when the halo accrete half of its mass or whatever. So what we did, we went to semi-analytic model of galaxy formation. And since that little probability terms, right, is just Gaussian, we could do it from Gaussian simulation. And so we went there and we check whether there is any observation, I mean, some feature in the spectrum of the galaxy, color or something like that, that would correlate with the formation type of the halo. And we couldn't find it. So in other words, if you could observe the halo and the halo had a sticker that said, I form half of my mass by that redshift and I am in the 10% oldest halo of my class, then you could sort of weight your halo and actually say, let's only take the old one because the old one enhanced my signal. But since you don't have anything like that, the galaxies that form in the halo don't have this memory, at least believe into the semi-analytic model of galaxy formation that in principle have information about the entire merger history, or so they say, then it's okay. Basically, what you're going to measure is going to be basically the prescription that theory give you for the average value. So this effect is not important. We try to push things around, and it's an effect that can be as, mean, if you push things, you can get 20%, but 20% is not a problem. You're ever but wrong by 20%. So be it.
Know about the range and details, you say one cannot?
So basically, this is saying if I select emission like galaxies, a redshift 2, do I select halos that form extremely recently and therefore kind of really mess up my prescription for the non Gaussian halo bias? And the answer is no. They live in slightly younger halo, but I'm not, you know, the 10% of the youngest. Or if I select very red galaxy, do I select old, very old halo? Well, the halo are a little bit older than the average, but they're not the 10% oldest of the average. So the remaining effect on your FNL would be 20%. So what? Increase your error by 20%, so be it.
So you say that correlation between the age of the halo and the age of the galaxy is not very strong.
At least in this semi-analytic model, where the author says they keep track of the entire merger history of the halo. It's raise a question that is, you know, why observation would not correlate with the age of formation time, but let me push on. And I want to show you a couple of tantalizing hints that came out this year only. And the first tantalizing hint is this one. So this is 2235. And it's a cluster at redshift 1.4 with a very large mass. So this is a monster and should probably not be there. So this is the Lensing contour plus optical, and this is the X-rays plus optical. The declared survey area is 11 square degrees, and this is all done in this paper where the author did a very, very, very careful job in order to measure this mass. They went through for X-rays, optical velocity dispersion, weak lensing done in several different ways. Okay. So, if I consider how many objects should I have in the entire sky at redshift 1.4 or higher with a mass greater than the central estimate, then I expect zero. If instead I take the lower mass estimate, I expect 7.
And so this is what we pointed out in this paper, and was then repeated and confirmed by several other works. But we know that if you add some small primordial non-Gaussianity, you can really boost a lot the probability of the very rare events. And this is by definition a rare event, because, well, it shouldn't be there. And so it turns out that, you know, depending on which formula for the mass function you use, you can really boost up this abundance by, you know, factor of 10. But we should be careful. Their declared area, survey area, is 11 square degrees. So if you do that, you get a probability that is very small of finding that object. You know, remember the sky at 40,000 square degrees. But actually, if you go behind the scene, then you know that this was found in the XMM serendipitous survey area. And you know that in 2006, when they asked for HST time to do this 11 square degrees observation, they have covered 165 square degrees. So if for your area you take 165 square degrees, then your probability is a little bit better. But then you can even be meaner and say, well, actually, the full survey is 400 square degrees. And then imagine that they didn't say everything that they had to say, and then you take 400 square degrees, then your probability is this. You still, it's an unlikely event. But, you know, the amount of boost you need depends on what was your survey area. And the other tantalizing hint I want to show you is the NVSS autocorrelation function. So NVSS are radio sources, and the NVSS autocorrelation function has been known for more than 10 years to be weird. You know, the correlation function at some point should go through zero. And in a lambda CDM model for this kind of object, it should go through zero at a few degrees. But if you look at the data, the correlation function keeps on going. And this, you know, has been a puzzle since the 90s, since when the survey was finished. So explanation included tinker with the redshift distribution of surfaces or tinker with the evolution of the bias. So these surfaces are biased, and you just choose some bias evolution that is very weird. So what happened since then is that, well, first we have a better understanding of the bias of quasar, maybe not radio loud, but we have a better understanding of the bias of quasar, and so this explanation is a little bit less appealing. And then lately, some group went actually measure the redshift of some of those objects, you know, hundreds of them, but still you can get a handle of what the redshift distribution is. And you can't tinker anymore too much with the redshift distribution of those sources. And so what we try to ask is, well, could it be FNL? And so these are the data. This is the Gaussian prediction, and this is the non-Gaussian prediction with an FNL of order 50. Now, we have to be a bit careful here, because you are trying to look on large scales, and this kind of survey may have density gradients on larger scales. So we talk to the people that did the survey, and we say, well, how big do you think this effect could be? Give me, you know, your most pessimistic estimate. And we still marginalize over that, and still the signal remains. So my point being, if there is an FNL local of the order of few tens out there, today we have the capability of seeing. But extraordinary claims need extraordinary proofs. So before I conclude, let me skip on a couple of things where the point I wanted to make is only that when you arrive to FNL of order 10 or 5, no data set is completely clean. And even in the cosmic microwave background, you do expect an FNL of the local type of the order of, say, 10 or so. And one of the effects that we think would be the dominant one, but there are a lot of other effects that come after this, is simply the cross-correlation between the primordial, the Lenzing, and the Riesz-Schama, that is the non-linear ISW effect. That gives you a bias spectrum, is a non-zero bias spectrum. It's something that looks a lot like local. And if you don't know it, you're going to measure a local non-Gaussianity of order 10 in the cosmic microwave background. So let me put it all together and stress the complementarity of these different approaches. So up here, CMB bias spectrum and halo bias. Planck, CMB pole, something like Euclid, and something like LSST. And these are one sigma error for local, equilateral, or enfolded type. And remember, there is nothing here because we know that halo bias is not sensitive to equilateral, so you can have as big FNL you want, you won't see. And down here is the number of sigma detection that you expect for non-Gaussianity that you know it's going to be there. And for the large scale structure is GR type effect that you can have, you know, one to two number of sigma detection, but there shouldn't be in the cosmic microwave background because it's not there, you're seeing pi directly. And for the secondary, there should not be there, but here you expect three sigma or even five sigma. So this is really complementary because you have to see your primordial signal in both tracers, otherwise, you know, you don't trust it. And also by combining them, you can get some handle on the shape. So let me finish. Let me leave my conclusion up because I'm out of time. Let me just say that predicting or constraining on Gaussianity is ready to become a branch of precision cosmology. Large scale structure can really help. This requires accurate analytic calculation and high resolution numerical simulation to calibrate it. So let me stop here.
You might learn from the high redshift solar quasars?
In the sense of as rare events or their clustering?
They seem surprisingly abundant.
So the main problem as using like rare event is that it's very difficult to keep them on mass. And so if they're really rare, a very small error on the mass can really change things a lot. So that's why we were really excited of 2025, because the mass is estimated with weak lensing, velocity dispersion, X-rays, etc., etc. But we are reconsidering quasars, Sloan quasars for the cluster, because those are also rare events, and you can go to relatively large scales. And if there's anything that is not a systematic effect of NTSS, maybe you should be able to see it in those, so we are considering that, but it's still work in progress.
Another question? Last one?
You didn't mention at all 21 centimeter. Do you think this is a promising way also to measure non-Gaussianity?
Yes, so with 21 centimeter you could trace basically the baryon distribution, but now these are not halos and so they are expected to be relatively unbiased. So you could measure the bias spectrum of that distribution and that could be an option. Yes, that's also a promising approach, but I don't know what the time scale for those experiments. It's much longer time scale than something like, say, FANSTAT, it's taking data already. So.
Okay, so let's thank Lissy and those speakers.